Tatars. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. The Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As a next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of two Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. The situation was dangerous for Israel. They were looking for a way to stop Arafat. It seemed impossible in a region where no country recognized Israel. At the same time, when tensions are rising in Lebanon over Arafat's presence, Fatah stepped up its activities. Some people in Lebanon did not want Arafat to use the land as a base for a war against Israel. All the opposition came from the Falangis movement, an organization that was created from the merger of some Christian Lebanese groups. Arafat did not want to destabilize Lebanon, but as the Christian paramilitary groups continued their provocations, some Fatah forces got into conflict with them. Once again, it was springtime and Palestinians hit hard luck. In a surprise attack on a bus, 27 Palestinians and Lebanese were killed. The Falangis claimed responsibility for the attack. The Lebanese government asked them to surrender those responsible, but they refused and took control of the area. No one expected such an attack, as the Falangis were just a political movement in Lebanon without much military power. A young man named Bachir Gemayel becomes commander of the armed militia of the Falangis. A month before the attack, they rapidly transformed into a disciplined and well-equipped military force at a time when they received multiple ships full of weapons and military equipment. Something was written on all of the equipment made in Israel. It meant that Israel has started a proxy war against Arafat. At the moment when Arafat needed foreign help more than ever, things did not go well. In Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser's advisor and deputy succeeded him, but he took a different path.
Let us agree that whatever happens between us, we should solve it together through, talks rather than going to war.
Egypt could retake the Sinai Desert after 20 years of Israeli occupation and then avoid conflict with Israel for the sake of establishing peace. But it wasn't the end of the story. Arafat asked different parties to help establish a ceasefire. In no time, the pressure piles up on Lebanon. A part of the Israeli army enters southern Lebanon with the help of the Phalanges. Arafat decided to seek help from outside the Middle East to solve the problem. Arafat thought that the U.S. was the only country that could help him in this matter. Israel accepted the ceasefire at the request of Washington. A year has passed after the ceasefire, and during this period, Israel kept many Israeli forces on the border on standby. They wanted to speed up the war, so they appointed Ariel Sharon as the Minister of Military Affairs. Violence was the most prominent characteristic. In violation of the ceasefire deal, on the morning of the 3rd of June, 1983, Israeli forces prepare for all-out attack. 120,000 soldiers, backed up by 1,600 tanks, moved on Lebanon. Only in 2 days, the Israeli army reached the outskirts of Beirut without any major impediment. Even resistance within the cities could not slow down the Israeli advance. Arafat issued the order to retreat to all of his forces in order to buy time to reinforce. Now, the enemy was behind the gates of the city.
We are here, and we will continue to be here, and we will defend this city, the first, it is very important, it is the first Arab capital which the Israeli are blockading. It is very important. You have to put in consideration what it means for the next generation. What have been done, you will pay its price.
Sharon's helicopter landed at Beirut's military airport so he could meet with the Phalange leaders. Arafat's bases were bombarded at his orders. For him, destroying Arafat was the main goal. A missile directly hits his office. But Arafat had left the office a few moments earlier. He was cornered, he was completely surrounded, and had no way to escape. For 9 weeks, gray clouds covered the sky over Beirut, the defenseless city. Israel claimed that the targets of the attack were Fatah forces, but it is unarmed civilians who suffered the most. Arafat had to make a hard choice. To what extent did the people have to pay the price for the war? What had to be done in order to get out of this situation? And who could help him?
Good evening. President Reagan said today he's lost patience with the continuing bloodshed in Lebanon, and he all but demanded that it stop, telling reporters he intends to make that point quite firmly with Israeli officials.
American representatives enter Beirut to establish a ceasefire once again. The U.S. won Arafat's confidence and, more importantly, convinced him to take all Fatah forces out of Lebanon. In return, Arafat asked for the security of Palestinian refugee camps. In the end, the Falangists also reached their goal. After 7 years of war and bloodshed, their leader was to become the president of Lebanon. Fatah forces said farewell to Lebanon in several stages. After a few days, the final group prepared to leave. Arafat was the last person who was going to say farewell to Lebanon.
This is a part of the long march,
yes,
to our independent state, to our capital, Palestine, Jerusalem.
Arafat stepped into the path of the unknown with an unknown destination. It seemed that fate had driven a wedge between Arafat and Palestine.
Meanwhile, the number of dead and injured in yesterday's explosion, which killed President-elect Bashir Gemayel, has reportedly reached at least 60. No one yet has claimed responsibility for the bombing.
No one knew who carried out the explosion. But the Israelis and Falangists accused the Palestinians. Sharon claimed the Fatah forces had not completely left Palestine and were hiding in Palestinian camps. So he ordered a lockdown on them to find Fatah forces. He went to the Sabra and Shatila camps for the start. Fatah's base was located near the camps. The residents decided not to resist against Israelis and the Falangists. After 3 days, when the Israelis surround the camps, the Falangists were allowed to enter the camps and trigger a catastrophe. According to local sources, 3,000 people died in that massacre. Many of the bodies were beyond recognition. Many were buried in mass graves in order to hide this atrocity. The Lebanese government could only identify 300 of the many victims.
Colonel Naftali Bairi says he thought the Christian militia was sent in to drive out terrorists, not to kill civilians.
Do you think it was right to let them in there?
Maybe it was right to let them in, but nobody thought that that's what the result.
Arafat was shocked after he heard the news. He had trusted the U.S., but now faced what he feared most.
Protesting against these massacres and genocides against the Palestinians, which have been planned and organized by the Israelis, by the Israeli troops, and I'm sorry to say, and covered completely by the American administration.
5 months after the Sabra and Shatila massacre, a court hearing was held in Israel to shed light on the event. During the proceedings, it was revealed that the explosion was carried out by a Christian member of a Syrian organization and that the Palestinians had no involvement in the incident. Although Sharon was blamed for the negligence, he continued to remain in his post. And even in the next administration, only his ministry changes. When Arafat wanted to set up Fatah anew, he faced a crisis. He was confused for a few months, but he finally settles down in Tunisia, 3,000 kilometers away from Palestine. The long distance would make it very unlikely that war would be dragged to Tunisia. But at the same time, the distance had made continuing the struggle a daunting task for Fatah.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and welcome to another episode of your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we were talking about the concept of human being in the Holy Quran, and in the previous episode, we talked about how the Holy Quran presents some origins for the righteous deeds, as righteous deed is an essential factor in the salvation of mankind. Quran also presents some of the origins, some of the elements that we need to have the righteous deeds, and one of the elements was patience, and we talked about different verses of the Holy Quran introducing different situations and occasions that require patience. And we ended up talking about one situation for patience, which is when you want to invite others to righteous deeds. Sometimes you yourself do something good. Sometimes the next step is when you have done your own duty, it is also recommended that you also invite others to that righteous deeds. So this verse is وَأْمُرْ أَهْلَكَ بِالصَّلَاةِ وَاسْتَبِرْ عَلَيْهَا, that we have responsibility towards our family members is a fact in the Holy Quran. And in another verse where he said قُوْ أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا, save yourselves and your family members from the hellfire. And there's a hadith that a Muslim, one of the Muslim community at the time of the Prophet, when this verse was revealed, came to the Prophet and he was crying and he was stressed out. And the Prophet asked why. And he said, because I was not able to save myself from hellfire, it was already difficult for me to save myself from hellfire. Now, وَكُلِّفْتُ أَهْلِي, now I have a duty towards my family as well. And because he had thought that, for example, he is responsible for the result. The Prophet ﷺ told him, no, you're not responsible for the results. You're responsible for the act itself, meaning that as long as you invite them to the righteous deeds and tell them what is wrong and what is right, and tell them that this is the correct process to develop a habit for doing the right things, for example, as long as you do your duty, you carry out your duty, you will not be responsible for the decisions that they make. But some people, unfortunately, they don't even do this little. Like, they don't take steps in telling their family members about the things that they need. Imagine about the secular dimensions of life. For example, you have children, you want to raise them in a society. You have to tell them and teach them certain things in order to survive in this society, right? So, and if you don't teach them that, people regard you or people consider you blameworthy. Like, why didn't you send your children to school? Because if they want to have a decent life in this society, they have to have proper education. If they want to have, and there are different layers of preparing your children for a prosperous life. For example, a person, it is only enough for him to send his children to school, but another person, he takes it to another level, like, for example, having other classes, teaching different skills to his children. And he wouldn't say, now, this is too much for my children to learn. No, he says, because at the end of the day, they're going to need it. And yes, it is difficult a little bit, like, for example, to wake up every morning and go to school, and all of that is difficult. But parents manage to make it easy for their children because they know the necessity of the process itself. But when it comes to religion, some people, they fall short. We will have a break and come back to talk about the duty that we have towards our family members.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to the Program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the duty that we have towards our family members according to the Holy Quran. And so we understood that this duty is there. As in the secular life, we have a duty toward our children to prepare what they need, to train them in order to have a prosperous life in future. And if that training is a bit difficult, we try our best to make it easy for them. Also, with regards to the eternal salvation that they need, we have to prepare the ground for them. And again, we have to make it as easy as possible, but we should not cancel it. We should not just make it off and say, no, this is not an option. So the first step is to accept that this duty is there. The second step is how to carry this out. And there are many people who have motive for this and who have accepted the duty, but they don't know what to do. Now, Quran has one thing to tell us at some level, and there are other things as well. But this one thing at this level is patience. You see, some people, they fall into the trap of impatience when it comes to dealing with other people. Dealing with other people is very complicated. And people, they have their opinions, they have their emotions. They don't necessarily think the way you think. Even identical twins, they have their differences of preferences. So you cannot expect your children to think like you, to understand things like you. You should be patient in this process that you have. Quran says, وَاسْتَبِرْ عَلَيْهَا وَأْمُرْ أَهْلَكَ بِالصَّلَاةِ. You invite your family members to salat, which is just an example. It could be about any parts of the religion. And you should also be patient in this regard, meaning that do not hurry. Many problems that we see in the process of preparing the ground for the religious upbringing of children that parents have is that because they are impatient, they think it's just a business of overnight. For example, they say something and he listens to you and it finishes. No. Just look at the example, the lives of the prophets, divine prophets. How much they spend day and night calling their people, including their family member, our own prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. How long he tried to invite his own people, his members of the tribe, like close relatives, his uncles, were his most or serious enemies. So it's possible that, but you should not lose patience. You should not say, for example, now this is finished and there is no other way. As long as there is patience, there will be a way. There will be a strategy. And other ways also, I mean, other techniques and strategies are necessary. But the key for all of those other things is that patience a person has. So Quran says, one of the situations and occasions in which we need patience in order to both carry out our own righteous acts and deeds, which is praying, and also inviting others to the righteous deeds, which is وَأْمُرْ أَهْلَكَ بِالصَّلَاةِ, for example, is وَاسْتَبِرْ عَلَيْهَا, is patience. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us in carrying out our own duties and also calling others to the duties that they have. Thank you very much for listening and keep me in your du'as until next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain is ranked 37th out of 39 nations in the European Union and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, based on income poverty rate for children and their success in reducing child poverty in a time of prosperity. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. A report by United Nations Children's Agency UNICEF said child income poverty rates in the United Kingdom were the highest among the world's richest countries, ranking bottom of the table for changes in those rates in the past decade. The UNICEF report, published on Wednesday, 6th of December, looked at relatively well-off countries to assess the rate of child income poverty combined with child poverty reduction rates. Britain ranked 37th out of 39 nations in the European Union and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, based on income poverty rates for children and their success in reducing child poverty in a time of prosperity. Only Turkey and Colombia ranked below Britain, based on a statistical average of the two indicators. When measuring percentage changes in child income poverty rates in 2012 to 2014 and 2019 to 2021, Britain lay bottom of the table of 39 high and upper middle income countries with a 20% rise in child poverty rates. At the other end of the spectrum, meanwhile, Poland, Slovenia and Latvia topped the rankings with a reduction in child poverty rates by more than 30%. The United Kingdom also ranked 28th out of 39 countries on the most recent relative child income poverty levels in 2019 to 2021. Chief Executive of UNICEF UK, John Sparks, said, "While some countries in this group have taken steps to increase support, in Britain we have seen a reduction in spending on child and family benefits and more children growing up in poverty as a result." In response to the report, a spokesperson for Britain's Work and Pensions Department claimed that they had worked hard to halve inflation and are providing households help with the cost of living crisis, including increasing benefits by over 10% this year. The Department for Work and Pensions said, "There are 400,000 fewer children and 1.7 million fewer people in absolute poverty when compared to 2010, but we understand some families are still struggling." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. According to a new independent report, the cost of child poverty has soared over the past 8 years under the Conservatives and has now reached £38 billion a year. The findings, to be released in the next few days, will add to concerns over government plans to end the £20 a week uplift for universal credit, as MPs of all parties voice concerns that a cut will hit low-income families with children particularly hard. The new research by Professor Donald Hirsch of Loughborough University is the third study of its kind he has conducted over the past 15 years. Professor Hirsch's latest work found that the cost of dealing with child poverty has risen in total by £8 billion since 2013. According to the Labour Party, after taking into account inflation, the cost has grown in real terms by about £4 billion, despite repeated government claims that it has reduced child poverty. Professor Donald Hirsch's study shows the increased cost is determined by four key variables: the level of child poverty itself, earnings and benefits, general level of public spending, and specific policies that direct public spending towards children in low-income families. Responding to the study, the Shadow Child Poverty Secretary, Wes Streeting, who commissioned the research, announced the Labour Party will establish a new child poverty reduction unit inside No. 10 Downing Street if the party comes into power at the next general election. Labour leader Keir Starmer will require the unit to deliver a cross-government strategy to reverse the huge rise in the number of children living in poverty since 2010, when the Tories came to office, and the surging costs to the Exchequer. Wes Streeting said, "The number of children living in poverty in Britain continues to soar under the Tories, and with it the cost to the taxpayer. The Labour Party will ensure that children are no longer confined to the Tories' poverty trap and increase opportunity for those who have been denied it." Professor Hirsch added, "The full human cost of child poverty is impossible to estimate. Nobody can measure adequately the cost in physical or emotional suffering of growing up in a damp or overcrowded home, of having a parent who relies on charity to put food on the table, or of going to school in shabby second-hand clothes. But alongside the human cost, research has shown that child poverty has a huge financial cost to the public purse and to the economy. The ITV television network has also covered this story. According to a charity survey which suggested the situation has worsened since last year, more than 130,000 children in Britain are living in the most extreme form of poverty. A rise in levels of destitution has been described as stark and worrying by Buttle UK, which works with children and young people in crisis. Its survey of 1,240 frontline professionals found that some 60% of children they work with were living in destitution, up from 45% reported in the previous year and 36% reported in 2021. The charity, which publishes annual State of Child Poverty report, recently said, by extension, the families our frontline workers are supporting includes approximately 132,000 children living in destitution. The year-on-year change between the last three survey cohorts dramatically illustrates the progressively worsening circumstances of children in poverty. The charity described the term destitution as one describing the absolutely lowest standard of living any adult child or young person can experience, adding that the lived reality is degrading and unsustainable. Social change organization The Joseph Rowntree Foundation defines destitution as meaning someone is going without the essentials needed to eat, stay warm and dry, and to keep clean.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer the queries, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Well, today in our studio, we have with us very talented expert. She is Sister Salma Khalafan, and the more I talk about her, it is less indeed. Well, she's an expert in Islamic upbringing, and today we have had this pleasure to invite her, and we're going to discuss some of the very important issues, especially regarding the teenagers, with her today. Assalamu alaikum, ma'am.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Sister Salma Khalfan, when it comes to upbringing in itself is not a very easy task, but when it comes to teenagers, they are kind of rebellious. They don't want to listen to us. They have their own rules, own world, be that boys, be that girls. They are have that rebellious nature when it comes to teenage. So why is the upbringing of a teenage child such a difficult task?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Bringing up children, all in all, is a very challenging task. And when we see that our children become youth, we feel that it's now the burden is lesser physically. But if you go and see, it's more mentally. that the challenges that we face upbringing a teenager that are more harder than those when you face when the child is young.
Yeah.
Because now the child has become a mature adult.
Yeah.
Understanding adult, though with least experience.
Yeah.
But he wants that independence of his own, and he thinks that he's right in every case, right? So, I feel that Imam Ali alayhi salam, as in the hadith, he quotes that, train your children according to the times that they live in. So this is a very challenging thing that we as parents were the generation before them, like maybe 20, 30 years before them.
Okay.
And when they come, then we think that, we were like this, so why not they behave like this? But times have changed. Everything has changed. Technology has changed.
And so
cultural influence and peer pressure and all in all, the environment, the atmosphere, the people, everything has changed, right? So we don't need to undermine the fact that if they are hard to train, and we should now try to understand it. Actually, the terbiyah has been so challenging ever since. So now, if we want to bring up the teenager according to a start ahead, then we need to empower our terbiyah. We need to put a new power in our tarbiyah, precision in our tarbiyah, according to the day and age, of course. And that will be long-term more effective and more long-lasting for them.
All right. So the important thing is that you have to empower your upbringing.
Empower it.
Right.
And that requires more struggle.
Yeah.
And of course, tarbiyah itself requires struggle. It's not something that, you give food to them, you are at their service, you bath them, you change them, or you listen to them. No, there's something that you have to have concern about them.
It's always said that they need more of your presence than your presence.
Yeah, I guess, more of your concern.
Yeah.
Your presence in the heart, as you say that, it's very important to bring the children with a heart. So a teenager himself or herself goes through a lot of changes, bodily and mentally and, intellectually, in every way, emotionally. So they are met with a lot of challenges outside as well as inside, through peer pressure, through, for example, in the streets outside when they go, their hormones are changing, when they're met with some immodest character, be hijabi or, unveiled. They really struggle hard, and they're not right age to even get married, because of the lack of experience and lack of education. The norm is such that they can't marry at the age of 17, although that's the right age if they're mature enough. But they just can't. It's not it doesn't fit in properly according to the way things go about.
Right. So we will discuss more about that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIV English Radio. We have Sister Salma Khalfan today with us, who's an Islamic scholar and an expert in the Islamic upbringing. Well, Sister Salma Khalfan, we had been talking about why teenage upbringing is such a difficult task. And first of all, you said that we got to be, as parents, stopping the expectations that as we had been behaving as teens, we should not be expecting our children today after some, that a generation gap now to be behaving the same way that we have been behaving, because time has changed and things have changed. There was no digital media at that time, but now things have totally changed. And a generation gap brings about so many changes. You said that there's peer pressure, there's physical, emotional and mental change in a child. And what we as parents need to consider is to empower our upbringing. Yeah. So what more we should be taking into consideration?
Yes, so as I said, that they're going through a lot of changes, so we should keep that in mind. And what kind of changes are they going through? And what kind of challenges are they faced with, which we were probably not facing at that time? So the formula of the upbringing remains the same, you know. And that's, as I'll mention later, but in itself, you know, the upbringing process is like a creative process, something that you need to make the fabric of with a lot of thought provocation, a lot of deep thinking, a lot of concern. It's not an easy task, you know, to put two and two together and get just four. No, you have to think about it and how to go about it. As far as teenage is concerned, more so, you know, than children also. So parents should not only, you know, run around doing things for children via the service. Like a father complains that, what more does the child want? He's behaving so, you know, badly, aggressively. Right. The mother is at the service and I'm at work, you know, earning so much. Whatever he wants, he gets. That's not all that they need. Right. The requirements are much larger than that, yeah. Right? So the main thing is the concern, which is very important. The concern, that worry, that how will you manage to make him happy and successful and obey the commandments of Allah. Because it's only through obedience of the commandments of Allah that a person can be happy. Be he your child, your husband, your father, or your workmate, or any friend of yours. If you want them to be happy, you know, that... Because the fabric of the soul is made up of the listening to the commandments of Allah. Right. So if any worldly, luxury is given or some kind of, any kind of, you know, treat is given, nothing gives that everlasting peace as much as obedience of the commandments of Allah and love of Allah reaps those benefits. So... Now, this concern requires thinking and action.
Okay.
Deep thinking and action. And what are the examples of this deep thinking and concern and action that we can take is through reading books.
Okay.
Empowerment of our tarbiyah is through reading the latest books written on upbringing of the child, watching them,
yeah.
Being alert about them, their feelings, ready to listen to them. You see, parents sometimes, they think that the children have grown up, the teenagers, so they feel that now, you know, like they have their own things to do and we have our own things to do. So they're not ready to lend a listening ear to them.
Right.
So when they notice these kind of things, these kind of reactions, they get so put off.
Right.
And they feel that we are acting indifferent. Whilst we might be very innocently doing it, for example, whilst doing our daily course, you know. Or a father whilst he's watching television or reading the newspaper, or mother whilst cooking.
And they notice things.
They notice these things very much and it affects their souls.
Right.
It makes them feel that we are indifferent and we don't understand.
Exactly. Now it's important what parents have to be doing here. And I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIV English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Sister Salma Khalfan with us, who is an Islamic scholar and an expert in the Islamic upbringing. Well, sister, you had been talking about the teenage upbringing, and it's really a difficult task. Now, a teenager who is suffering from a mental change, a physical change, an emotional change, starts noticing small things very in detail and feels that his parents are very indifferent when they don't show that concern. Like you said, a father feels like I'm earning and I'm bringing things home. But, you know, as we said earlier, like bringing presents is not much important rather than your presence. So your presence at home is really important and giving them quality time. So what else should parents be doing to make these teens feel at least... some kind of peaceful.
Yeah, wanted, right? So it should be also like comforting them, answering their questions, showing love for them, even if they've grown up, you know, to show that physical bond is very important. And comforting them, ready to talk to them, you know, like being ready. Sometimes, you know, we see that when teenagers grow up, the first sign they show is that aloofness. They want to be on their own. They're quiet. So we should go to them and tell them, for example, talk to them and tell them, I understand what you must be going through.
All right.
I probably have been through that too. You know, and remember that if you want to talk about it, I'm there for you. And the child is sure to come. It's guaranteed to come because he has to or she has to talk about it to someone or the other. Let them not talk to their friends or peers about that. Let you be the first person for them to turn to. That friendliness should be there for you to support them, to show that supportive nature.
Right. So as teenagers, there are teens who need some time, who need some attention. You're saying that you never know what kind of fears they have, what kind of friends they are hanging around with, and then you should be yourself the first people to be answering
to
them.
Yes, that's right. So a rule in bringing up the children is that however much they are closer to their birth age, they can take more influence. You know, however much they are closer to their date of birth and the year of birth, they will be influenced quicker if you give them the right tarbiyah.
So the earlier you start...
Exactly. The earlier better. You start, the better it is. So don't wait to, ingrain such good qualities like truthfulness, trustworthiness, good etiquette, in their own level, of course.
Right.
From a young age.
Exactly. Because there are some parents who feel like, who say, our child is still young. Like if someone tells them, your child does not have a good tarbiyah, he does not have a good upbringing, what are you doing? You're not concerned. They're like, oh, come on, she's a child, he's a child.
You should not take that easily, right?
Yeah. You're saying that as the, even if they are younger, that's the best age to get started.
Yes. It's their own level, in their own capacities, of course.
Right. So, I think it's a kind of topic. We need to discuss more about this, and time is running out today for today's session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any queries, you can feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also listen to our programs again. Go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. You can go to the tab Call of Islam, COI, and find out an archive of our programs there. Also, look for us in the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.